You're listening to Lips LA with Scott Lips.
Hey, it's Scott, and welcome back to yet another episode of Lip Service. I'm super excited today to bring you an episode with the Black Crowes. Rich Robinson, Chris Robinson normally don't do a lot of interviews. Truth be told, one of my favorite bands of all time, one of the greatest live bands of all time, over 30 million records sold, one of the most rock and roll bands in the world, according to Melody Maker. And again, one of my very favorite bands. It's a coup. Appreciate you guys tuning in. This is the third installment of our collaboration with Spin Magazine. So excited about the collaboration and lots of great shows coming up. I think we have Living Color coming up next Monday, Danny Clinch next Tuesday, and David Duchovny to follow. So quite a few guests coming up that are very exciting. Excited for alls to come. And again, I couldn't be more elated to have the Brothers Robinson on the show. These guys have been away from us for way too long. I want to say 6-7 years. They announced the tour right before the pandemic. I actually got the pleasure of seeing them at the Troubadour on the first reunion show. And now they're back. You know, I think they're one of the first rock bands actually to tour post-pandemic. So excited to have them here. Coming up in just a moment, Chris and Rich Robinson from the Black Crowes. Hell yeah.
You're listening to Lips LA with Scott Lips.
Our show today is brought to you by the fine folks at Thursday's Boot Company. You guys have seen me rocking these boots in every other picture I have on Instagram. I'm always repping them. Thursday's Boots is a bootstrap startup that makes the best handcrafted boots and sells them direct to consumer at some of the lowest markups in the footwear industry. Thursday's Boots tagline is highest quality, honest prices, because they use some of the best materials like full grain leather, supple glove leather lining, and gold standard Goodyear welt construction. Thursday's Boot Company sells their boots at prices starting at just $149 with free shipping and returns. They've been featured in all the best fashion press, from Esquire to GQ to Cosmo and Vogue. And more importantly, they've gotten over 20,000 five-star reviews from real customers. Thursday's boots are perfect for people who understand quality and don't want to pay a high retail markup for a great-looking pair of boots that are built to last. So check them out at Thursday's Boots on Instagram. My favorite shoes, my favorite boots. You always see me repping them. You'll love it.
You're listening to Lips LA with Scott Lips.
Hey guys, it's Scott Lips, and welcome back to the show. Lip Service brought to you by Spin Magazine. Very rarely am I this excited about our guests, but I'm elated to have on the brothers today, Chris and Rich Robinson. How are you guys doing today?
Good, good.
Awesome. Good, great man. To see you guys. Rich, thank how you doing?
I'm good. Thank you.
Where are you guys? Where are you at, Rich?
I'm in Nashville.
Nice.
Or Franklin, I guess, just outside.
Awesome. Well, we're going to talk about the tour. I think actually the tour kicks off in Nashville, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Awesome. So you're celebrating 30 years, one of the most iconic rock records ever, Shake Your Moneymaker, one of my favorite records. By the way, you guys are one of the best live bands ever and one of my favorite bands, so I appreciate you being here. I think July 20th in Nashville is when the first show kicks off, and you're actually the first rock band that's doing a tour post-pandemic. How do you guys feel about touring now with everything going on in the world?
I mean, we're over the moon. You know, I know it's been tough for everyone, and you know, but especially, you know, like every single musician that we all know, no one could go to work. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. Imagine, you know, if you're a YouTuber or something, you could continue to work through that. But like, you know, other stuff is. But you know, I've said it, and I think it's. You know, it's worth mentioning that, you know, I think one of the only reasons like we didn't go absolutely crazy is everyone's in the same boat, you know.
Yeah.
It changed the trajectory of everyone's lives. The richest corporations in the world got way richer, and all the family-owned businesses went out of business. but everyone had to deal. It didn't make it easy, and it didn't make the anxiety any less or whatever, but at least everyone was in the same boat. And but we're unimaginable, our excitement, ready to go.
Definitely. Do you think you'll have like a new appreciation for touring in this sort of post-pandemic world that we're in now?
No, I mean, not for me. I mean, I have a new appreciation for not touring, because that was the first year and a half since 1989 that we weren't doing it, either as the Crowes or in our solo group. So,
yeah,
that's our, you know, that's just how we live. And but not doing it definitely makes it sweeter to get out to do it.
Definitely. Rich, you missed before you jumped on. I was telling Chris, many years ago, I used to go to music school with Chuck Brandt, also known as Johnny Colt.
All right.
We used to run around. We had a little band together, and we all went out one night. I think it was English Acid, Santa Monica Boulevard, and got into some trouble. And so it's great to see you guys again. I mean, I don't expect you to remember that because it's probably 1989, but that's how long my history goes back.
And he told, that's amazing.
I remember he told me, he's like, you know, I just joined this band. You're going to love them. You have to come out with us tonight. You know, we'll have a great time, and they're great guys. And I'm really excited about this project. So it's funny to see many years later, celebrating 30 years of Shake Your Moneymaker. And, you know, as I said, I'm super excited to be sitting with you guys. So during the lockdown, I heard you guys were working on some new music, right? With George, can you talk about how that went and what you have coming up?
I mean, Chris and I always write, you know, just in general, it's what we do. And it keeps me sane in a day, you know, to be able to write some songs. And, you know, I have a studio here. And so to me, it was one of the things that kept everything going during this time that we had, to be able to send songs to Chris and have him send me stuff and back and forth. And, you know, and also working with George again for the first time has been great. You know, it's been really cool.
Yeah, I imagine like throughout the years, right, the last 6 or 7 years, you had a lot of offers to get back together. And sort of, why do you think this happened now for you guys? How did it come to be?
I mean, I think Chris and I were ready. I mean, you know, you get away from the context. You know, when you're in a band, a successful band, we toured for 11 solid years without doing anything else. And we never stopped. And then took a break and then toured some more and for 5 solid years without taking a break. And so when it ended, we really had, or for me at least, I had 8 solid years of, you know, doing my own thing, you know, putting together another band. I played with Bad Company to help, you know, Mick, Ralph, Scott Ill, and I filled in for him for a tour, and I did this Hendrix thing and scored a movie and produced a bunch. And so to get out of my comfort zone and then get into these other sort of scenarios, and me being in my solo stuff and other bands, I mean, I was more in the position of what Chris was, you know, and it was an eye opener, and it really showed, I learned a tremendous amount, and I learned about how, you know, personally, you know, the things I was bringing to the relationship that would annoy the shit out of him, you know, right. What I mean, too. You know, it's never just a one-way street. It's easy to say that guy's a dick or that guy's a dick, you know. But if you look at yourself and you understand and you grow up and you learn, you're like, wow, okay, yeah, I see. And so I think after all of that, for me personally, you know, when this came up and we talked about it, and I was ready, and I also at the end of the day miss my brother, you know. Definitely. So ultimately that's why it all started for me, at least.
Yeah. And I want to say, I would imagine like the last 7 years, every time you'd write songs through your writing process, you probably had Chris's voice in your head. Like, what would this song sound like if Chris was singing it? So did you ever think to like reach out and be like, hey, here's a new song I just wrote and love to have you sing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there was always that inclination. I've always written for Chris's voice. You know, even when I write solo stuff, I always hear Chris singing it, you know, So yeah, there was definitely that.
Awesome. I was actually at the Troubadour show. It was a great show, by the way. So talk to me about the current lineup. I know Sven's back in the band. So talk to me about the lineup now and where that's
at. Yeah, we're super stoked to have Sven back. And I mean, he's been a part of, you know, even though he wasn't in the band early on, we've always been in the same, you know, we were
his bubble.
His high school band played with our high school band, and you know, that we all lived in the first band house together, and there we got their record deal first, and you know, we were all like, oh fuck, you know. But we've been in each other's orbit since 1985, and we're super,
because he was actually the first bass player before Johnny, right?
No, we had another Atlanta guy who's not with us anymore named Scott Shamel.
Yeah. Okay.
Sven had a band called Marry My Hope at the time.
Right.
We were signed to Beggar's Banquet.
Yeah.
Rough Trade or whatever. And so we're super happy to have him. And, you know, it was another bummer, not just to be on the road, but we, you know, put together this awesome band. And, you know, we're super excited for people to, you know, like some people know Isaiah Mitchell from Earthless, a great, great rock and roll band. But we're super, you know, blessed to have Isaiah playing guitar. He's incredible talent. And then we have Joel Robineau on keyboards, who is also has a band called Once in Future Band from Oakland. That's one of my favorite bands in the world.
Sure.
And is another just, I mean, Joel's, you know, he's a whole thing onto himself. I don't know if Joel's in our band or we're in his band. We're figuring.
That's fine.
And then we have Brian Griffin on drums, and Brian just joined the band. So yeah, I mean, you know, we get to Nashville in a couple of weeks. We couldn't be more excited about like the group of people, and you know, everything's really positive. You know what I mean? There's everyone's happy to be there. Everyone knows what the deal is. We're playing this. You know, the focus of this tour is Shake Your Moneymaker,
and yeah,
you know, we expended a lot of energy throughout the years trying to be expansive, and you know, pushing our, you know, all the influences coming in and different kinds of music, you know, not making the same record twice, taking our live shows, I mean, seeing where they could go, different cover tunes and playing rarities and, you know, release songs. So I think for us to take that same type of passion and energy and put it into a more focused presentation, and i.e. Shake Your Moneymaker and the subsequent sort of singles and the most popular songs, it's just super cool. You know what I mean? Like, it's, we're not doing the same old thing. We've never done this. So for us, it's new. And I think that kind of dynamic is exciting for us. You know what I mean? Oh, wow. You know, like, again, you know, we've been writing a lot of songs. We definitely will make a new record, but the focus really is to how much can we pour into this, you know what I mean? And like, make this special. And for me, that's been like one of the coolest things, you know, cause I mean, except for the time of making Shake Your Moneymaker and getting to that tour cycle or whatever, we never had that kind of focus in the same way. Mal Southern Harmony, because we knew that record was special. You know?
Yeah. Well, the truth is you guys never really played this record in its entirety from start to finish. Right. And I feel like there's songs like I think Strutting Blues and Thick and Thin. I don't even know if those are kind of deep cuts that you didn't play much either, right?
Strutting Blues, we never played, until, you know, until we did these warm-up shows. But then we played Strutting Blues, and we were like, why haven't we been playing Strutting Blues for 30 years? It's killer, you know?
Yeah, well, there's some great stuff on the box set. I mean, there's amazing covers. There's great tracks that I had heard before, but I hadn't heard all the stuff. So if you don't mind, I kind of like to walk back to the beginning, though, because the inception of the band is so interesting to me. And if we talk about the early days, there's even stuff from Mr. Crow's Garden on the box set, and I'd never heard some of those tunes. And so talking about like the inception of the band, I think I know you guys grew up around music. Your dad was in folk music. I think he even had a couple top 40 hits, right?
Yeah. In the 50s, he had some like more like kind of Bobby Darin rock and roll kind of songs.
Yeah.
And then in 1960, he signed with ABC Paramount as a folk duo. So yeah, he changed gears as well from like this kind of rock and roll thing to a folk thing. So yeah, music has always been a huge part of our life.
What was your sort of first memories of music growing up? I mean, was it folk music or was it, because I know later on it was like the Dolls and, you know, obviously REM and all that stuff, but early on, what were the first memories you have of music?
I mean, for me, it was dad playing old folk songs, you know, like Shady Grove and like all these kind of folk standards in a way, but
yeah.
He would really make that. I was always really interested in the lyrics and the stories, and dad was a really good singer, and he had a really cool, you know, traditional picking style with his finger picking style. And besides that, I mean, you know, when our dad was a salesman, sales rep, so he was gone a lot. But when he would be home on the weekends, it would be like, my earliest memories are Sly and the Family Stone records,
awesome.
Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young records, like Mad Dogs and the Englishmen, stuff like that, you know.
Yeah. And Rich, what about you? Because I know you got a guitar. I think you were in like junior high or something, right? When your dad finally gave you a guitar.
Yeah, I remember like the earliest song I remember hearing was Carry On, that on, you know, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young.
Sure.
And I remember our big like console stereo that we had, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember Sly Stone and you know, listening to, and Dad would always listen to that. I mean, you know, I was 2.5 years younger than Chris, so when Dad played those folk songs, I mean, I was probably in bed a lot of the time. But yeah, I got a guitar. I started picking up my dad's guitar when I was about 14, and just learning stuff off of like the TV, just, you know, songs I heard or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And then Dad wasn't too thrilled with us playing his guitar, so he's like, all right, I'm gonna buy you guys a guitar, put that one down, and here, play this one. And, you know, I mean, he was always really supportive, but that's what I remember the most, you know. And I still have that guitar that he didn't want me to play.
Because initially, Chris, you had a bass, right? And I think your cousin was on drums or something.
Yeah. The very first sort of attempts, we wrote a couple of songs, kind of sounded like the Cramps a little bit, kind of vibe.
Yeah, I remember. Cool.
And I was kind of playing bass, but then I would sit down and show our cousin the drum part, and then I'd run back to the bass, and then I was trying to sing, and then I was like, fuck it, I should just be the singer, you know? Right. Like,
and musically, it was what, about 1985, right? So the climate was definitely like all the hair metal shit that was going on. And it wasn't obviously, you know, it wasn't what you guys were doing and what you guys started to get into. So.
Yeah, we weren't MTV kids, you know, like Quiet Riot and
right.
Twisted
right.
Sister. That music looked kind of, I mean, you know, I guess you could say Black Flag and the Circle Jerks were silly too. But
yeah.
We were punk kids and, you know, we were into Echo and the Bunnymen and like, you know, I remember the day Pornography came out, the Cure album, I like bought it, had to get it, and The right. Replacements and REM and just, you know, we were way more on that side of the culture of rock and roll. And, you know, it also was pragmatic, you know, because it's like, we didn't really, you know, what are we going to go see, fucking Loverboy or some shit like that? We were going to like a little weird punk club. And,
right.
And then before that, my first concert experiences were all black music, you know, I
saw
Time and Vanity Six, Lakeside, SOS, yeah. Rich and I went to see Cameo, you know, like Prince was so big, early Prince. And then it's funny because the next thing, it's like, oh, it's, but I think for us too, like X, a band like X and
sure,
a band like
X.
Gun Club, you can really hear the Gun Club in our music too. You know,
yeah.
We have those Mr. Crow's Garden days. We had a jangly thing. And then when we started, that was super 60s and REM-ish. And then when we wanted to get into a harder sound, it's kind of sounded more cow punk than anything else.
And yeah.
Lack of a better thing.
Yeah.
But that was all this, you know, we wouldn't have gone, you know what I mean? We wouldn't have gone to like a big concert at the Omni or something. We
went to
little weird clubs. And the hardcore scene was great because it was all ages. It was always for all ages. You know,
when did you get into like Nick Drake and Johnny Thunders and all that kind of stuff? Did that come later in life for you?
No, I mean, it's, you know, we're into, but while all this is going on, we also listen to shit tons of Bob Dylan. And we let, like Rich said, there's these classic rock elements that we love too. And Nick Drake just came, you know, Nick Drake comes at the same time, Graham Parsons and Alex Chilton and Nick Drake and Syd Barrett, you know?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
But I'm, you know, you have to realize too, I'm obsessive record collector and just a music, you know, person. Like, you know what I mean? I'm always looking for something to listen. You know, I'm searching, you know, I've been collecting records since I was about 12 years old, you know.
Wow. So. By the way, you can never live where I live, Chris, because I live on the same street as Amoeba. It actually just reopened on my street. So The new amoeba opened up on my block. So now I'm like,
if I lived on your street, I would just open my house as an amoeba annex.
Right. So it's literally on my block. And every time I leave my house, I'm like, there's a fucking amoeba. I better go in there for a couple hours.
Just go buy records.
Yeah, everybody should be buying records for sure. So, well, this is, I guess, 85, 86. Was Driving and Crying happening at that point or not yet?
Yeah, they start around the same time, you know. I mean, I'm not sure when the first Driving and Crying, that very first record, but no, we love Driving and Crying, you know. I mean, for us too, but they, you know, they took our drummer and they were kind of competition. So we would be kind of like, fuck them when we were kids. But I had great times at Driving and Crying shows. And Kevin Kinney is a great songwriter. And, you know, the original Driving and Crying was awesome, amazing shows. And, you know, that whole scene, like we were saying, Driving and Crying got signed to a major, Marry My Hope got signed, we got signed. I mean, there was a lot of, and then bands in Athens, there was a lot of, you know, for a local music scene, there was a lot of national attention there in terms of record companies.
Definitely. So walk me through that process of, you know, meeting George, and obviously from Mr. Crow's Garden to the heavier sound that you guys progressed to, which is obviously Shake Your Moneymaker. Because like I said, the folk element, when you listen to those early demos, Mr. Crow's Garden, I actually never knew how folky the band was. I mean, compared to the, you know, the heavier sound.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, She Talks to Angels is an offshoot of that.
Yeah, and, yeah.
You know, I think that's more actually a Mr. Crow's Garden-y type of song in a way. I don't know if Rich agrees, but...
Yeah, Rich, do you agree? When you listen to She Talks to Angels, because I noticed that was actually on the demo stuff, I think, from Mr. Crow's Garden on the box set. Was that the first song that you wrote together that you're like, this is it for us? This is going to be, you know, the song that's going to take us, you know?
No. It was not in a million years, no. Okay. I mean, I was into the song. I thought it was really cool and, you know, and...
But it was the open E tuning too, right?
Yeah, yeah, it was open E tunings. There was a kid in Atlanta that actually showed me that tuning. He was like, man, you should check this out. Because I was really getting into Nick Drake. A friend of ours who worked at a record store gave Chris Time of No Reply.
Yeah.
Time of No, it was before the box set came out.
Oh, right,
so,
right.
Yeah, so it was Time of No Reply. And I remember listening to Fly like 100 times in a row, just like, and it was the demo version that Nick did. And it was something that really struck me instantly. And so I just wanted to jump into open tunings. And so I, you know, James Hall showed me open E, and that's kind of how I got into it. Realizing later that I had always been drawn to it anyway, with the Jimmy Page stuff, you know, the and Stills and all these different people.
And the Keith stuff too, right? Keith Richards.
Yeah, yeah, and Keith.
Yeah.
So and the funny thing, just hearing you guys talk, and we got into rock and roll backwards in a sense, you know. Yeah. What I mean, like,
right.
we were born into it, and then we went off on our own tangent, you know. We got into Prince and, you know, Funkadelic and Sly Stone and all these different things, and then we went into like a you know, our own alternative you know, journey, so to speak. And it's and then we got into, you know, and through that, you know, like punk rock. And then we kind of landed back into rock and roll music, because rock and roll encompasses every bit of that.
Definitely.
Sly Stone is as rock and roll as Keith Richards. You know,
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah, like, yeah. 100%. Maybe more.
I mean, and so is, yeah, Joni Mitchell. Yeah, and, you know what I mean? And so is Dylan. And so are all of these people.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for us, ultimately, that's what... you know, to sort of land on this springboard, sorry, it's a lot of chaos over here, to land on this springboard of rock and roll music as Chris and I's, you know, platform of expression, so to speak, you know, I don't know. It's just, it's amazing to me.
I mean, it is, you know, it is funny because George, you know, I remember, you know, George sitting me down and at where I was living in, and he was like, he played me Miss Judy's Farm by The Faces. And
right,
it's like, I was like, oh my God. And how raw and stuff. And like, you know, at that time, 1971, like, was like, there was nothing cool except Can or, you know, like, or David Bowie or, or whatever. I don't know. Maybe the first Dolls record is 71, 72.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So Stooges or whatever, right? So like this, that era of rock, and then especially Humble Pie and Free, Terry Reid, and even Zeppelin to some extent had yet to like come full circle to where it's universally cool, you know?
Definitely.
Like,
yeah.
You know, all sorts of people. So like, you know, dude, it's same thing like wearing bell bottoms. People were like laughing at us. I was like, y'all laugh all you want, man. We look rad. You know what I mean? Like, and you know what I'm saying? So it was kind of, in a way, it's punk as fuck to like adopt that at the time. Like, you know what I mean? It was
definitely
against everything. Anyone, mid-tempo things, you know, like even like, a, even on our, you know, I look at Shake Your Money Maker. We do an Otis Redding song. No rock bands were doing that. I mean, it's also our influence of black music in, that other rock bands didn't have at the surface as much as we.
Right, were. Right.
Even though we, you know, the drummer was incapable of swinging, we were a rock band. But you hear a lot of that influence, you know, hopefully in the most respectful and best way. But
definitely. So you guys are all living together, I guess, what it is, 86, Mr. Crow's Garden, you were spent.
87, yeah. I mean, Rich was still at home.
And how was that? What was that household like with all you guys living together back then?
The band house was disgusting, really, but amazing. You know what I mean? It was our first taste of freedom. You know what I mean? It was like wildness and, you know, I was crazy, you know, free. I mean, I literally was probably a little crazy. I think some people maybe were a bit worried about me, but, you know, we'd have these wild drunken nights. And I'm like, the next morning I would make everyone go to Oakland Cemetery and write poems for an hour. And then at night we'd go under the streetlight and read them as loud as we could, you know, all this weird, weird stuff, you know, but it was also intensely important to the commitment of the life of that, you know what I mean? Like in my mind, I was like, here I am. I just turned 21 years old and I haven't made like an important piece of art yet. So I, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Have to work really hard, have to be special, you know what I mean? And then rock and roll, as you know, and remember, the culture was so different. Rock and roll was important. Not only was it $1 billion industry, the record business, it was important. People listen to artists, what you wore and the music you listened to said a lot about who you were in society and in the culture, you know, and that you weren't a part of this and you were deeply a part of this, that, you know what I mean? The outsider element of it, all of it. It was an entirely different planet.
Definitely. And how did you guys end up meeting George? Because obviously it was a long, I think he actually loved your covers first, right? And it was sort of a long drawn out process because by the time you met him to when you got your deal, I feel like he kept like trying to push you along, but he was obviously, he was taking his time with the whole process, right?
We had met, we were actually the same guy that turned me on to Nick Drake kind of quote unquote managed us.
Okay.
And he got us into a studio to do some demos. He sent the demos out to A&M. And
was this, probably was this Aaron Jacobus?
Yeah, Aaron Jacobus. So sure, he mailed them out to everyone. He mailed them to Aaron in particular.
Yeah.
And Aaron, you know, was cool. I mean, he, you know, sent us to do multiple demos, you know. So we did do two or three demo sessions in Raleigh, kind of outside of Raleigh, North Carolina, with this guy, Steve Gronbach.
Mm.
And it was cool. And for us, you know, it was like taking forever. You know, I was like 15. And Chris was 17 and we're like, why is it taking so long to put out a record? You know, why can't A&M just sign us? And so,
maybe because we're very good.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, a couple of years later or a year later, I'm not great with year timelines, but, you know, we're playing in New York and it was actually, on a short run that we did. I think it was New York, Boston, and something else, or maybe it was just New York, but we played a show and George was there. And he had heard discussion of us at some meeting at A&M and he wanted to come check it out. And that's where we first met him.
He had flown to Atlanta. George wanted a rock and roll band. That's what he was looking for his first signing and stuff. And I think he had been in Atlanta, and we, you know, we didn't have a lot of gigs, but someone at a coffee shop or at the pizza place or something said, "Oh, Mr. Crow's Garden's a rock band. They're like a rock and roll band." And that's, I think, where he heard the name of the band. And then, like Rich said, we played this place called Drums in New York, and we were like a third on a bill of six or something. And he came backstage and introduced himself, and we played Down in the Street by the Stooges and No More, No More by Aerosmith in our set, you know, with our originals.
Yeah.
And he was really into it, and he saw something, and we exchanged numbers, started sending him some demos, started working on some. I mean, like Rich said, to us, it was like fucking like sitting through Lawrence of Arabia. You know what I mean? Right. A movie that will never stop. And it was only really 18 months or something. But George, you know, he kept, you know, he was the one, and to this day, you know, he instilled a work ethic that's important. And he instilled, you know, without, you know, I think we always knew the songwriting was ultimately the most important, but George made sure we, you know, really worked hard. You know, I mean, we talk a lot about, you know, the first kind of, wasn't She Talks to Angels as much as, and I don't think we ever thought of a song as like, oh, this is going to be a big single or whatever, but Jealous Again's a big song for us because, you know, Rich has now, you know, found his way to Open G. We kind of, you know, we want this rootsy band. We love the Stones, Faces, AC/DC, you know, like this guitar. We want this thing with this kind of bluesy sound. And then Rich comes up, we come up with Jealous Again, but, you know, Jealous Again takes a while too. George is like, okay, cool. You know, we record it on our little condensed mic fucking thing and then send it to him in New York, you know, because he's coming down every few months or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like, that's pretty good, but not good enough. Get in there again. Until finally we come up with the song and we look around, me, Rich, and George, and we're like, wow, you know, now, you know what? Now that we know that we can climb this peak or whatever, not fall off or die of lack of oxygen, that sets the template. Boom, there's Twice as Hard. There's, you know what I mean? Then all the other songs start to fall into place pretty quickly. But with a lot of work and a lot of focus and a lot of trust, you know what I mean? Because I think we would be very sensitive about someone who wanted to turn us into something we weren't, you know?
Yeah, I think the advance was something like $5,000 for that record, right?
I mean, I don't even know if that's an advance or more like that's something you borrow from your parents.
Right.
Okay. Right. I mean, by the way, if your parents were my parents, they wouldn't have given you $5,000.
Right. So needless to say, your parents were supportive or not supportive of the career choices you made?
They were supportive. They
were worried, but they were supportive.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I wanted to ask you too about one of my favorite bands of all time, who you guys actually took on the road years ago, is Jellyfish. And I know there was like a side project many years ago you guys worked on. Is that ever going to see the light of day? I know it was like something
with
Jimmy Ashford.
We did this thing called Sweet Pickle Salad.
Exactly.
I'd have to find Jim Mitchell and find the tapes. I haven't thought about that in a long time. I mean, Jellyfish were, I mean, I haven't seen him in a while, but Roger Manning's still a great friend.
And yeah. Yeah.
Back in the early 2000s, even Andy's worked on a couple songs with us. And back in the 90s, there was even talk maybe of Andy being the second drummer, all sorts of crazy stuff. But
that sounded like the ultimate band to me. You guys together was like the ultimate band. So that sounded incredible.
They were a great band, man. And I mean, it's a shame they only made those two records, but they were great records.
Definitely. So jumping ahead to like 1994 now, do you think if Amorica came out now on that album cover, what do you think the public's reaction would be? We live in such a weird, sensitive time now.
I don't know.
I think it would be less.
People don't care. They don't care anymore.
It's interesting because at the time it was so controversial, right? But now looking back on it, I just wanted to hear your thoughts on.
I mean, at the time, marijuana was illegal everywhere too.
Right, you know what I mean?
Like, that is true. A lot of shit has changed, you know?
Right.
I mean, I think, you know, again, I don't think it's like the spinal, it's not like Spinal Tap where it's like, oh, she's being sexist. So it's fine.
Yeah.
I don't, the image wasn't, is not to be taken literally. You know what
definitely,
I mean? The image
definitely.
Is more about the gratuitive nature of American culture.
No
about,
question.
You know, the shallowness of things, you know, the cover, the music is, that record is supposed to be deep and there's a lot of dark themes, but the cover is supposed to be a juxtaposition of that and almost humorous. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's more making fun of America as this sort of bloated, you know, underneath it all, we can't deal with our own desires and sensual behavior because of this, you know, deep Puritan streak that runs through us that everything's sinful and bad, you know?
Yeah, true. Do you ever see a time period where maybe, you know, Mark Ford comes in for a gig, or you bring some of the other guys back just for one night? She had some
Hold
amazing
on, Rich,
players.
Rich, ready? 1, 2, 3. No.
Okay. I don't know if that's something you guys.
All the best to Mark Ford. I got, you know what I mean? But no, we moved on.
All right. Well, let's talk about the 30th anniversary, obviously. Shake Your Moneymaker, the box set. There's some amazing songs on the record. And I want to talk about sort of some of the covers on the record and some of the tracks that you feel like, you know, you hadn't, Rich, when you go back through the vaults. What are the songs that you were like, wow, that's great. You know, I wish I would have heard that earlier.
You know, I mean, to me, like Charming Mess, I'd totally forgotten about. And then to get it and listen to it, I'm like, damn, that's a pretty good song. You know, like I was pretty happy with it.
Good chorus.
It totally spaced on, I knew that we had done 30 Days in the Hole at some point, but I did not know we did it on Shake Your Moneymaker. I kind of thought it was a little bit later. And Jealous Guy too. I mean, to hear all that stuff for the first time in years, in decades, definitely. I mean, it's pretty far out, you know, to listen to that. And it, I mean, it's amazing, you know.
And Waiting Guilty, yeah. Of course, right?
Yeah, but Waiting Guilty, we had played and it was released as a B-side somewhere.
Mm. And we played
and so
it.
That song was still kind of in our purview, you know.
Yeah, it would pop in our set rotation sometimes.
And obviously Jealous Guy, talk about like some of the covers, Jealous Guy, Get Back, 30 Days in the Hole, just how those all came about back in the day.
I mean for me personally at that age, it's far easier to sing Hard to Handle than 30 Days in the Hole. I mean, Jesus Christ. I mean, Steve Marriott still, like, you know, we heard Are You Ready the other day on the radio or whatever from, you know, Rocking the Fillmore. And I was like, with my wife, I was like, fuck, man, listen to that dude. I mean,
yeah.
It still is just so powerful, so soulful, so at ease in that range and that power that most vocalists, you know, they're going to lay down after show. He's like, let's do another one, you know? But that was, you know, that was in our, we loved the, you know, like we loved Humble Pie, you know,
yeah.
And we love that song. Imagine we've maybe played it every once in a while in a show, but like we love the Beatles. We love John Lennon. We love the Beatles, and we heard the Faces do Jealous Guy. So we were like, oh, let's, you know, we can't sound like the Beatles. Not that we sounded exactly like the Faces, but oh wow, this fits what we want to do.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. This fits the presentation of the other songs. You know, because we're not in a place yet to have the type of finesse and musicianship and dynamic to, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, this is day one stuff. You know,
definitely.
That's the first time, you know, I'm standing in front of a real microphone trying to sing. That's the first time, you know, where Rich is working hard with George on that, you know, guitar sound. You know, Rich doesn't have a sound yet. That's his first time you hear Rich on a record. You know what I mean?
Right.
And later he would have a sound that's very identifiable with Rich, you know. So when all these things are the very first time, you know what I mean, they take on just a different, I wouldn't say there's like a level of importance, but there's just, it's just different, you know what I mean? Like, oh, now I would take it for granted and anyone that works with me that I know how to stand in front of a microphone and deliver a vocal, you know,
right.
At that time, I wasn't even very, you know, compared to day one and 30 years later, I'm a much better singer, you know,
no question.
But we had one thing and that was a lot of energy and spirit. And, you know, like I said it before, we played Jealous Again probably the first day we probably played it 6 or 7 times. And then 3 days later, we probably played it 5 or 6 times. And then maybe one more time, we played it 4 or 5 times. You know what I mean? Like that we don't do that anymore either, really, because
yeah.
You know, we just did the lights on, the red lights on, go, you know, like, and, you know, this isn't Pro Tools. No one can fix anything. You have to get the best take of the best, you know, you get the best performance of the best song that you can do.
I was going to say, when you go back and listen to this record, there's a great story about Thick and Thin, about even the car crash. So talk to me about that story, because I love that story.
Yeah, I mean, that's... It's funny too, because that's in the studio. Like we're in there from, you know, 1 in the afternoon to 4 in the morning, you know, trying to get it done. That's how it used to be. And we were, you know, it was near the end of the session. We were goofing around and we were doing it really to play a trick on the engineer.
Right.
And so we were like, oh, we want to record Rich playing guitar outdoors, you know, like Led Zeppelin or whatever.
Yeah.
And so we put all these bottles and stuff in an empty dumpster. And Steve, our drummer, had this beat up old piece of shit Dodge Dart. And he used to crash it into stuff all the time anyway. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And so we had him bring out the mics and Rich had a guitar. Like, let's get some levels, you know. And then like we said, okay, you ready to record? And he put the car in gear and smashed into the dumpster. And like, that's, and then we all were laughing because he thinks he's going to hear an acoustic guitar track. And it's these asshole kids crashing a car into the dumpster in the parking lot of the studio. So that was like the big joke. And then we were like, oh, put it in front of the song. You know, it's great.
It's also pre-sampling when you couldn't just sample it from a record, right? It was like, let's do this the right way. It's a 37-day
record, you know.
Yeah, totally. It's a 37-day kicking off July 20th. Dirty Honey's going out with you guys. How'd you guys find them?
Our manager manages them.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Because they're definitely heavily influenced by you guys, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're cool, man.
Yeah.
We're super excited to have them. And they're doing really super. It's exciting for rock music to have a young band that people are noticing. And I just think it makes the whole package more exciting, you know, to have them out there. You know, I don't know the other dudes in the band. I know Mark, the singer, who's very good, powerful vocalist. And we're just super stoked to have them out with us.
That's awesome. Do you ever see a day maybe when you do like a Southern Harmony tour one day?
Yeah, maybe that would be rad. I mean, you know, like I think a lot of people would like to see that as much as they'd like to see this.
Yeah, you know? Definitely. I would definitely like to see that for sure. So August 19th at the Forum in LA. Hope to see you guys. Jones Beach, September 17th, a 37-day run. Hey, man, it was awesome seeing you guys. I mean, it's been 30 years since I've seen you guys together, like hanging out with you guys. So it was.
Dude, you're not supposed to remember a night out at a club called English Acid. Right?
Well, I remember because it was with you guys and we had a good time and it was like something that stayed in my memory forever. So I'll never forget it. But I appreciate you guys coming on. Check out the tour, check out the box set. Definitely go buy your tickets, and 100% I'll see it one of these shows coming up.
Sounds right good.
Thanks so much.
I appreciate
so
it, guys. All right.
Appreciate it.
Well.
Have a good one.
You too. Bye.
You're listening to Lips LA with Scott Lips.
There you have it, folks. Chris and Rich Robinson from the Black Crowes. Thanks for tuning in. That was another great episode. Great to hang with those guys. As I said, I met them many, many years ago. So that was awesome. Looking forward to their tour and glad that life is getting back to normal as we know it. Hopefully I'll get to catch those guys in New York or in LA. I'm headed to New York tomorrow. Got a bunch of interviews set up there soon. Thank you for tuning in. Tell a friend, tell 10 friends if you like the show. And as always, much love, take care, rock and roll, and see you soon.